In that day, says the Lord through Amos, in that day I will raise up the booth of David that is fallen and repair its breaches and raise up its ruins and rebuild it as in the days of old, that they may possess the remnant of Edom and all the nations who are called by my name, declares the Lord who does this. Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when the plowman shall overtake the reaper and the treader of grapes, him who sows the seed. The mountains shall drip sweet wine and all the hills shall flow with it. I'll restore the fortunes of my people Israel. They shall rebuild the ruined cities and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and drink their wine. They shall make gardens and eat their fruit. I will plant them on their land, and they shall never again be uprooted out of the land that I've given them, says the Lord God. And well done. If you've been here over the summer, that is the end of the prophet Amos, and it's the only happy bit. Some people are here for the first time, they don't realize this, but for 9.5 chapters, Amos has been very miserable, and rightly miserable. I mean, there's been a lot wrong with the country of Israel, where he's been sent to be a prophet. So Israel, instead of worshipping the true God, they've set up fake gods, shrines to golden calves, and they worship there instead. And it's kind of a little bit Christian. They kind of keep some of the Bible, but they also do other things their own way. It's a kind of religion, how they'd like it to be, rather than how God said it should be. They worship God on their own terms. And this enables them to be greedy and prosperous and to look after just themselves and to oppress the poor and to trample the needy and to exploit those at the bottom of society so they can get ahead. And God sees this and he's angry about this and he sends the prophet Amos, and they're not really interested. They say, you know, Amos, shut up. Things are going pretty well in this country. We don't really want a religious nutter like you talking about the end of the world. But Amos has been talking about the end of the world for 9.5 chapters. And if you've missed it, it's probably not really fair that you get to jump to the happy ending. It's like watching the sort of the final episode of Better Call Saul. We're just about to begin the final season. And, you know, to watch the last episode when you actually need to invest 6 seasons worth of time first. It's probably not really fair to start Amos here. So if you've missed it, if you've arrived here, why not go on the website and hear some of what you miss? I think particularly the last, well, probably because it's recently in my mind, but the last 2 chapters have particularly challenged me. So maybe you want to listen to those online. But here's the issue. Israel is totally broken. And the question of, can it ever be fixed? How would you fix something that had gone this wrong? And I guess it's a bit like the world's in general, isn't it? I mean, I suppose people differ on whether they're optimists or pessimists about this world. But you don't have to look that far to see in lots of ways it's broken. I mean, it's broken because of global health. Not just the pandemic, which killed some people, but now all of the unexplained excess deaths since the pandemic, people dying of other things because NHS waiting times are so long and so on. Health is broken. Education is broken because children are out of school for 2 years and everyone's behind, and that's a big challenge. How are you going to get back those 2 years? Mental health is broken. If you've tried to get mental health help, particularly for teenagers, but for many people, massive, massive waiting lists. Peacetime is broken. And that was a shock, wasn't it? We thought the pandemic was the worst thing that could possibly hit Europe. And then Putin invaded Ukraine. It seems like one thing on top of another. Politics is broken. No one trusts the politicians. Everyone's pretty cynical about the leadership race. How would you fix it? How would you fix the world? And of course, some people are optimists. And I think that the Western world has kind of fluctuated between optimism and pessimism over the last 100 years. Maybe I don't know history well enough. Maybe it's always done that. But, you know, at the time of the beginning of the 20th century, massive optimism. Technology increased life expectancy, peacetime, and then 2 world wars pessimism. Everyone was pretty poor. Lots of people were dead. And then in my childhood, optimism, and we really thought we could fix the world. And even better science, even better medicine, even more peace. I've lived in peacetime. I mean, there was the Falklands War when I was young. Some of you remember that. Mainly it's been peace. And it's quite a shock to discover there's another war in Europe with a guy who's got nuclear weapons that I don't know how many minutes it takes, but he decides he's had enough of us and presses the button. And well, we're certainly within the blast radius here. Pessimism, worry, anxiousness. How do you sort it out? And here's the interesting thing. You might have felt, if you've been at Amos over the last few weeks, or if, even as I'm talking about it now, you might think Christians are very pessimistic people. They're always talking about sin and evil and God's judgment and all that's wrong with the world. And yet here's the interesting. I went to the Summer Fellowship a couple of weeks ago. On Wednesday nights, we've been doing Christian heroes of the 18th century. And we were doing George Whitefield, who's famous to be the guy who campaigned for the end of slavery in the British Parliament for pretty much his whole life. He became a Christian, I think, age 20, 21. And then for the rest of his life, he campaigned to end slavery. But we discovered one of the things that really struck me, and maybe if you were there, it struck you as well, that George Whitefield was a really happy guy. Apparently he was going around always singing, always smiling, always playing jokes on people, always laughing around. And he was the guy that ended slavery. He also thought, and this was the real surprise to me, that the key to Christian joy was being real about evil and sin and how messed up the world is. And I thought, how do they connect? Like, shouldn't the person who is calling out evil and seeing all the social ills of the society, and shouldn't they be gloomy and depressed? But weirdly, he combined a belief that the world is very broken and that we are very messed up with God with incredible joy. And I thought, how does that go together? And I thought, well, it only goes together if you're sure that the world can be fixed. You know, you can only laugh about a terrible medical diagnosis if you're really confident about the miracle cure. And then you can laugh in the face of it and say, it's okay, my doctor's got it sorted. And it puts a smile back on your face. Even then, probably you delay the smile until it's actually happened, don't you? But here is Amos, who is, I don't know, I tried to try and do a relative gloom level of Old Testament prophets. I mean, he would be quite near the bottom, I think. Here is Amos suddenly bursting forth into joy. Because even though the world is very messed up with God, it can be fixed. What I love about this question is it's really a question that affects every single person in London, not just Christians. You know, there's a mess in London. I mean, Christians have a particular view about that mess. It's a spiritual thing and an evil thing. It's a moral thing, as well as economics and diseases. But everyone knows there's problems, and everyone's looking for solutions. How would you fix the world? Maybe this is a question. We're always trying to think of ways of engaging our friends in stuff we're doing at church. So why don't you in the office tomorrow, at the school gate tomorrow, wherever you are tomorrow, say, we're discussing an interesting question at church yesterday. How would you fix the world? And what do you think is the solution? Why don't you ask them? We'll do a little survey and you can let me know for next week. How would you fix the world? Well, this is Amos's answer. This is God's answer through the prophet Amos. And it's a very simple one, actually. It's a simple solution, but maybe not the one that most people would instantly think of. How would you fix the world? I was going to put point one, crown the right leader. Maybe if you can relate to that. You know, leadership is important. I don't think anyone thinks that Rishi or Liz are going to fix Britain. I mean, whatever they say, we're comparing who will do the better job, but no one thinks, yes, they will be the savior of, you know, sort everything out. But people kind of think maybe leadership, the right leadership, is important. Maybe a change in leadership in Russia would be important. Maybe the leader of America is important. You know, that maybe it's something to do with that. But it's not quite crown the rightful king, because God does it. And in fact, God has already done it. So point one, watch God crown the rightful king. And his name is David. So verse 11, on that day, says God, on that future day, I will raise up the booth of David that's fallen, repair its breaches, raise up its ruins, rebuild it as in the days of old. Restore the kingdom of David. Now, this is a strange thing to say because David's been dead quite a long time by now. We're several generations after David. But what he really means is restore a second David. A David-like ultimate king. David was the best king of Israel, and we need another one like him. If you look at the bottom of the service sheet, I've done a little diagram of a load of leaders of Israel, and you'll see there's two Davids in there, and I've called one of them David. He's in the middle, and the other one David II. It's actually not really his name. His name is actually Jesus, but I'm calling him David II. A king like David, a sort of Mark II David. That's going to be the key. The key to fixing the world is going to have the right guy running the world. The right guy on the throne. And at the time of Amos, this was a promise, a prediction. But at the time of preaching Amos, it's a done deal. Because God has already installed a new king. At the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. He's ascended to God's right hand. He's reigning. You wouldn't know that, would you? I mean, it's not obvious down here that Jesus is in charge. And that's because in history of the world, there's always a bit of a lag between, you know, sometimes you go on, I actually went name the country, but I can think of a country not far from here. And you travel there and everything's a bit quaint and sort of lovely. And then sometimes the locals tell you, oh, it's because we're basically 10 years behind. I won't say which country I'm thinking of. But, you know, it just takes a little bit of a while for the new innovations to feed through and for some of the terrible things to feed through. Well, it's a bit like that with the whole earth. We're a little bit behind because in heaven, Jesus is already on the throne. And on earth, everyone's going to bow before him, but just on a lag. It's just taken a little while to catch up. Install a new king, David. Of course, change of government can be quite controversial when there's already a government in place and supporters of the present government. If you followed Amos, you'll know that the guy currently on the throne in Israel is a guy called Jeroboam II. And the promise of how to fix everything is the promise that David will be on the throne. So you've got to read behind the lines here. How do we sort this out? Put David on the throne. Implication, get Jeroboam II off the throne. Yeah, the solution to the world is the right king and getting illegitimate kings out of power. Stop the people who shouldn't be running the world running it and put Jesus on the throne, David too. On the throne. There's a great illustration of this. The Australian evangelist John Chapman talks about coming to Britain and doing a tour of some of the famous places in London. And he goes to the House of Lords. I don't know how he got in, but someone with connections in the right places gets him into the House of Lords. And he sees the massive throne. Who sits on that? Does anyone know enough about the Lord Chief Justice or someone? Nathan de Killam would definitely know. The Lord Speaker, there we are, sits on a big throne in the House of Lords. And John Chapman, as a tourist, is doing going around the whole Houses of Parliament and sees this throne and says to his friend, can I go and sit on it? You know, can I try it out? Because, you know, Australians are pretty informal and this is maybe the kind of thing you might do. And his friend says, you absolutely cannot do that. You know, and there's a little, one of those rapes across and, you know, John Chapman's just ready to sort of climb over. He's like, stop, you know. I think, well, I mean, what would happen? Would you be shot? I'm not sure. But imagine that you actually managed to get past the security guards and they were, you know, distracted or whatever. And you got to sit down on the throne. And then the Lord Speaker turns up. I mean, it's going to be awkward. What's going to happen? And I mean, probably you just realised that you're in the wrong place and I'm so sorry. But imagine you just sort of sat there, you stayed there, and you're not supposed to be there. And the person who is supposed to be there turns up. Well, it's a fun illustration, isn't it? But that is what's going on in the universe. that it's Jesus' throne. And he's the one that God has installed as the rightful king. And so anyone else who's pretending to be in charge of the world has got to get off the throne. Jeroboam, get off the throne. Vladimir Putin, get off the throne. And Boris Johnson, I mean, he's getting off the throne, isn't he? But politically, it's true. But even in individual cases, it's true. In our own little worlds, our own little families, our own lives, we're not ultimately in charge. Actually, me being in charge of my own life messes up my own life. Have you discovered that yet about yourself? We're not good at running our own lives. And much better to put Jesus in charge than for us to be in charge. Number one, watch God crown the rightful king. Number two, everything else flows from it, really. Number two, experience the glorious blessing of his reign. Verse 13, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when the plowman will overtake the reaper, the treader of grapes, him who sows the seed. I don't know about agriculture for this to immediately resonate with me, but it basically means that things are so productive that all the seasons have sort of got out of kilter. So you're harvesting even before you've sort of done the stuff that's earlier in the year. And suddenly you've got a bountiful grain and you've got wine. And I will restore the fortunes of my people. They shall rebuild ruined cities and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and drink their wine. They shall make gardens and eat their fruit. I'm grateful to God for giving me an extra insight into this just last week. Some of you know Paolo, our international ministry trainee, who left us about 3 weeks ago and is back in his home country to serve the gospel there. He also got married this week, and a few of us went to the wedding, which is wonderful. And some of you couldn't see it on live stream because the Wi-Fi was too bad. I'm sorry. But we went to Paolo's house. And they're like, oh, would you like some lemons? Because, oh, yeah, they grow on that tree over there. Would you like some oranges? Oh, they're just over here. And would you like some avocados? Yeah, they're growing on our rubbish heap because someone threw away an avocado stone. And so 5 years later, obviously, here's an avocado tree. You know, it's like, it's so fruitful there. And just, I mean, quite a small garden. I mean, about, I don't know, a quarter of the size of this lecture theatre. And there's everything you would ever buy from the fruit and vegetable section of Tesco. And it's just sort of growing. And it, apparently it's fruits twice a year. So it's almost like the tree in Revelation. And this is the picture. You know, you got the right God on the throne. And suddenly society is so fruitful, so blessed. It begins to be restored or fixed or rebuilt. Watch God crown the rightful king and experience the glorious blessing of his reign. Verse 15, forever. Because, of course, there have been times of real prosperity and joy throughout history. And there's been times of prosperity for Ukraine. There's been times of good health for Britain. Politically, you know, you can find seasons where things are, I mean, in my life, you can find seasons where things are going really quite well. The trouble is, it doesn't end up lasting that long. A war comes along, a tyrant comes along. We make a stupid decision, sin gets the better of us, and things fall apart. But with this king on the throne, it's permanent. Verse 15, I will plant them on their land. They shall never again be uprooted out of the land I've given them, says the Lord your God. And then point four, and I think this is actually the most exciting point of all. Watch God crown the rightful king, experience the glorious blessing of his reign forever for everyone. Forever for everyone who turns to God. And here's verse 12, and I put it in highlighted. And you may not realize how significant these words are, but let me take you through them. That they may possess the remnant of Edom, and all the nations who are called by my name. Well, you may not know who Edom are, and you might not think that verse is important, but we know it's important because it's the place that in Acts chapter 15, they turn to at a moment of theological crisis. Here's the question. Who is really part of God's people? Who is welcome to be a real Christian? And in those days, they thought, well, you've got to be Jewish. Because, you know, God's promises in the Old Testament were through Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, the three Jewish patriarchs. And they were the people who had the sign of the covenants, the sign of circumcision, which is the sign of God's promises. And so surely, I mean, maybe you could make exception for someone who wasn't Jewish, but they'd have to kind of essentially become Jewish, you know, become circumcised, take on Jewish customs, because surely this was the people of God. And then they were having a debate about this because some other people seem to have become Christians who weren't Jewish. And the question is, are they legit? Are these other people really welcome? And they had this massive council to discuss it. And they say, well, it's pretty obvious if you do a Bible study in the Old Testament. Specifically, I'd like to quote to you Amos chapter 9. So this is the reading that they choose for their Bible study at one of the, you know, the biggest theological debate of the early church to settle a question. Amos chapter 9 says, everyone is welcome. Everyone is in. And this is how it says it. So I've drawn this little diagram, and I'm going to explain it to you. So on the service sheet, if you're online, I think you can get the service sheet on the website, hopefully, and that will explain it to you. But here are basically a sort of sped up genealogy of people in the world. So Adam, I mean, he's the first human being, and then Noah, he's the only family that survives the flood. And then fast forward a bit to Isaac, Abraham's son Isaac. And then a little bit later on, Isaac has two sons, Esau and Jacob. And then descended from Jacob is King David. Remember, David is the great king. And then after him, King Solomon. And then after him, King Rehoboam, King Jeroboam. And then some generations after him, David. So this is a sort of selected genealogy of some important figures from the history of Israel. But what you want you to notice is it keeps branching. And as the family tree branches, some people get excluded from the people of God. So Noah has three sons. One of them is the line that will lead to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, the Jewish people. But there's other people as well. There's other nations that come from Noah. So they're the kind of branching off the other nations. They're called the Gentiles. It just means the nations, the different ethnicities. So they branch off at Noah. Then Isaac has two sons, Jacob and Esau. Esau is rejected. He's cut off. He becomes the father of Edom. So the nation of Edom is the descendants of Esau. And they branch off. And then a little bit later on, Solomon, well, he doesn't have two sons, but he has one son, Rehoboam, who's really stupid. And because he rules so badly, there's a civil war. And a guy called Jeroboam the First takes off half the country in rebellion to be a separate nation. And that is Israel that splits off and Judah that's left. And so all the way through the history of the world, it's been the history of fracturing, fragmenting, and people getting further and further from access to God. You might think, if you looked at the grey box, God's people are only now narrow to the people of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, to the people of David, to the people of Rehoboam, to the people living in Judah, this small number of people who are really kosher, to use the literal term, who are really in. And then in this promise in Amos, Amos says to Israel, he's the one at the bottom who's cut off, I'm going to restore the booth of David, he was the king of Judah. I'm going to bring you back in under one king. End of the civil war. End of the divided kingdom. The beginning of the united kingdom. Not this united kingdom, but the Israel united kingdom. I suppose that you could imagine a Scottish equivalent. That's probably too political, isn't it? But you can imagine if Scotland does get independence and Nicola Sturgeon becomes queen or something. And forgive the political associations of this. And then how would you bring it back? Well, everybody back under the House of Windsor, something like that. You know, I'll unite again the kingdom under King David. And then I'll bring back the remnant of Edom. Edom? What, the people that branched off years and years and years ago under Esau? You'll bring back Esau and all his people, yeah. I'll bring back the remnant of Edom. And in fact, while we're at it, all of the nations that are called by my name. You know, bring back China. And bring back India, and bring back the tribes of all the different nations of Africa, all of the nations brought in. So this solution is kind of out of all proportion, really, to what Amos has been talking about. He's been talking to one little group, Israel, saying you're out of line and God's going to sort you out. But then it turns out that the solution for Israel is also going to be the solution for the Edomites, is also going to be the solution for all the nations of the world. And this is the way to fix the world. You know, you're not going to get global security by nuclear disarmament. It's kind of obvious, isn't it? I mean, someone's going to keep a nuclear warhead and then they can hold the whole world to ransom. You know, you can't do it. And you're not going to do it through political treaties. We thought we had, didn't we, with the United Nations, but it's toothless. You're not going to get people to be universally just through education. Incredible levels of education in the West, incredible levels of evil in our society, and child abuse and broken families and terrible things happen with educated people. How are you going to fix the world? Well, what about a king who reigned everyone with justice and righteousness, and a king who was so inclusive that he would have anyone back who would bow the knee to him? I wanted to say, what's God crowned the rightful king forever for everyone? Because that would be sort of neat to remember, forever for everyone. But I had to put this caveat in, for everyone who turns to God, everyone who calls on his name, everyone who is called. That's the way it's described in Acts, actually. They say everyone is included who turns to God, who will bow the knee to Jesus. Because, of course, the one way you're not going to be included is if you keep holding on to your throne. If you bow the knee to Jesus, he'll bless you. It's going to be amazing. But if you insist on running your own life and holding out against him, you're going to miss out. Everyone else is welcome. How would you fix the world? Well, it's all about a king, the amazing blessing that he brings forever for everyone. He turns to him. I'm going to leave a pause and then prayers.